This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Generation Xers like me came of age in what we saw as a golden age of cartoons. Berkeley Breathed's Bloom County, Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes, and Gary Larson's The Far Side became more than simple strips that we'd look forward to in the paper every morning. They became real cultural touchstones. I know people who recite philosophical musings and broad gags from these cartoons on a regular basis 25 years later. Many Americans of my generation collected the complete works of these cartoonists in softback books to be read over and over again. This week, a bit of that magic returned as Breathed surprised fans by publishing the first Bloom County in a quarter century. So it got us thinking about the power of cartoons to make us think and to even drive political dialogue. When blowhard Maine Governor Paul LePage joked about shooting a political cartoonist, it fell pretty flat, given the real-life killing of Charlie Hebdo cartoonists in Paris earlier this year. Given the digital world that's developed in the last 25 years, there are also lots of questions about how cartoonists publish their work, how they engage with their audiences, and how others easily steal their work. Today, Where We Live, two award-winning local cartoonists reflect on their work and the state of the craft. You can join us at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/Where We Live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Later, we will remember a Bethel artist, once known as the Dean of American Cartoons, who has slipped into obscurity. Joining us today from our New Haven studios is Dan Perkins, otherwise known as Tom Tomorrow. He's the author of the This Modern World cartoon, now celebrating 25 years with a new retrospective we'll be talking about. He's got a Kickstarter campaign. He's also recently was nominated as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Dan Perkins, welcome back to our show.
Hey, John. Glad to be here.
Also joining us in studio, for the first time in studio, and it's great to have him here, Bob Engelhardt, the longtime political cartoonist for the Hartford Courant, also once a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Bob, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
Bob, I'll ask you first. I'll ask you, Dan, to weigh in on this. We wanted to bring this together because of this milestone with Bloom County coming back. How big a deal is this for the world of cartoons, Bob?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a very big deal. And I like his reasons for it. No editors. He's not going to go to the newspaper route again. He's going to go online. I'm doing the same thing. I've got a little feature. I got a BobEngelhardt.com website, and I'm doing a thing called Stuck, which I'm just using stick figures, like in protest to all the stick figures you see. And for the same reason that Burke Breathed's doing it, no editors. I can drop an occasional F-bomb if I want to.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about getting published.
You're a little free from that. So that's one of the big things, clearly, he said about this. Dan, what else do you think is really big about this, about him coming back after all this time?
Well, personally, I'm just excited. I have a small personal connection in that I'm from Iowa City, and I was a young wannabe cartoonist working in a copy center when Burke Breathed was living in Iowa City because his girlfriend was going to med school. I actually have a thing up on my site. You'd have to search for it, but I actually recently posted an old article I ran across in my own boxes of clips about Breathed from the Iowa City Press Citizen from probably about 30 years ago. But he used to come into the copy center every day and copy off his cartoons, which was very exciting for me as the young wannabe cartoonist.
I have to ask you this, so just get this out of the way, Dan. One of your recurring characters in your strip is what looks like a penguin named Sparky. There's some dispute as to whether or not he's actually a penguin. But, of course, Bloom County's main character is Opus. I mean, was this an homage in
some
way?
It really was not. I had genuinely always drawn penguins in these little notebooks when I was, 5 years old. I was sketching these little penguin characters. So it was just a very natural thing for me to bring into the strip. But, of course, when I started doing it, Bloom County was still fresh in everyone's mind. And so people bring up that question. But honestly, it had nothing to do with Opus.
One of the things that Breathed said when he came back, this is from the New York Times, he said, I planned to return to Bloom County in 2001, but the sullied air sucked the oxygen from my kind of whimsy. Bush and Cheney's fake war dropped it for a decade like a bullet to the head. But silliness suddenly seems safe now. Trump's merely a sparkling symptom of a renewed national ridiculousness. We're back, baby. So it seems as though there's a lot of ridiculousness to write about. But Dan, the entire history of your strip is really in this so-called sullied air. I mean, can you talk about this? I mean, he essentially went away from drawing cartoons because it wasn't any fun. But this is the career you've made, drawing these people.
Well, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, you go to cartooning with the world you have, not the world you want.
I suppose. I mean, how has this time period that you've been in, I suppose, different than the time period that Bloom County was originally written in the 1980s, how has it shaped and influenced the work that you do think?
Well, also I think we may have a sort of rosy glow of memory thing happening here. I mean, we're talking about the Reagan years, which I recall being somewhat problematic and controversial. it's been interesting because I've been putting this book together. I've been going through 25 years of work, and it's been an interesting thing to look back over just the history of this and to realize that what I was effectively doing was kind of writing contemporaneous history a week at a time. You're shaped by what you're given and you deal with that. I mean, I think my strip was clearly very shaped by the events of 9/11 and the second Bush administration and what have you. It's just what I had to work with. Would that it had been otherwise.
and that's what's so interesting about the work that you do too, Bob, is that you really do have to work with what is at hand. And there is always something ridiculous to write about, and there's always something very, very serious to write about. And I suppose if we look back at the last 30 years, there's a lot of each. I mean, do you see that your work has changed in relation to the events of the day, or have you pretty much approached it the same way, no matter who's, in office?
Well, I kind of approach it the same way, but my work has changed quite a bit. I've been going through all my cartoons because I'm going to have an exhibit at the Connecticut Historical Society in the fall. And I'm going through all my cartoons, and I'm looking at the many, many different styles that I've drawn cartoons in. I always draw them pretty much the same way, but I render them in many different ways. And I've come across so many cartoons that I don't think I could get published today because times have changed, people have changed, culture's changed. It's an interesting examination.
Well, give me an example of something like that, something that did 25 years ago that you just don't think would get published today.
Anything about racial matters.
Mm.
And I was pretty bold about it, and looking to spark controversy and conversation, I don't think I could get those published today.
Hmm. Do you look back, because we want to talk about the book that you're compiling here. You've been looking back through your entire career, and you've even said there's some stuff maybe at the front that makes you, a little uneasy, like all of us as we look back at our early work. But are there some things you did back then that you don't think you could do now?
No, when I say that, I mean the work itself is a little wobbly. it took me a while to figure out what I was doing. But I've also always been doing this in the alt weeklies, and I just, when you say the internet means you have no editors, I've essentially never had an editor. So I've always pretty much just done, for better or worse, exactly what I wanted to do.
Mm. Now, this nomination for a Pulitzer is something that maybe from the article I read took you a little bit by surprise, given the fact that you're operating outside the mainstream of American cartoons. Were you surprised by this?
Yeah, I mean, what this means is when you're nominated, what that means is that there are three finalists that the jury chooses, and then that goes back to the Pulitzer Board, and they decide the final winner. But what this means is that I was one of three people who could have won the Pulitzer this year, and yes, I did not. I mean, I've entered every year just in the way that one might buy a lottery ticket or something, because it just seemed like I should keep my hat in there. Not that I buy lottery tickets, but I never actually expected to even make it as a finalist. And it's a slightly painful thing because it means you're very, very close to the brass ring, but not quite there. At the same time, a friend of mine said, "This is going to be the first line in your New York Times obituary, bud."
And you got one of those calls once, Bob.
Yeah, I always thought that was the great thing about used to be the great thing about the Pulitzer was that your name would be in Encyclopedia Britannica till the end of time.
There's an interesting side note, which is that my wife's step-grandfather, who she never actually met, was a man named Harold Talbert, who was a political cartoonist in D.C. in the 30s and 40s, contemporary of Herblock, who was a Pulitzer winner.
Well, the
whole idea, Bob, that you'd be in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, a lot of my listeners are out there going, what is he talking about? What the hell is an Encyclopedia Britannica?
Well, those were the days.
Those are the good old days. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're marking this historic week in cartooning as Bloom County comes back. It's gotten us thinking about the power of cartoons, comic strips, and how they help to shape our dialogue in America. Dan Perkins joins us. He's Tom Tomorrow, the author of This Modern World. He's putting together a 25-year retrospective right now. Bob Engelhart's a political cartoonist for many years with the Hartford Courant. If you want to join us and you've got thoughts or questions, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. So tell us about this compilation, if you would, Dan. You're putting this together, and you've got a Kickstarter campaign to do this. You're actually trying to get together all of the strips that you've written over all these 25 years. This must be quite an undertaking.
I've been working on it for about a year and a half. I've been working with this this company, these people I know, called Make That Thing, which exists to usher incompetent people like myself through the entire Kickstarter process, because honestly, I wouldn't even know how to lay out a book. I don't have those skills. But yeah, I've been compiling it and getting it laid out and getting it organized. And this has been more than a year's effort, and we have finally launched the Kickstarter. Now, I went to this thing. Now, you know, the people I'm working with are taking a percentage. Obviously, they need to be paid for their work. I wanted to keep the initial goal as low as humanly possible because I wasn't sure if, you know, I was asking people to support a 2-volume hardcover, 1,000-page compilation of every This Modern World cartoon. I had no idea if people were going to go for this or not. I had no idea how people would react. So I went back and forth with my partners. We settled on this initial goal of 87,000, which was no profit for me. I deferred all profit to those people, to my partners, because they had been working on this and they should be paid. I was getting a book out of it if we were successful. But that's how determined I was to keep the price as low as possible, and that's how uncertain I was that we were going to hit it. I thought maybe after a 30-day campaign, if I was very lucky, but, you know, I was having conversations with my wife saying, well, you know, like, should we get our relatives to be ready to pitch in thousands of dollars at the last minute if we haven't crossed the goal or something? And then, as it turned out, we hit 87,000 within 21 and a half hours and have kept going up from there. So it has been really just a stunning, stunning week. I've just been blown away. I mean, we're literally right now sitting at 180,000 on this thing. Last time I looked this morning.
Wow, nice.
So
very nice.
It has just my own expectations and my own sort of. There's been a lot of reason that we can talk about or not, but there's been a lot of reason the past few years for cartoonists to develop a pretty negative outlook about our possibilities moving forward into the future. And this thing has just blown my negativity out of the water. It's been insane.
Well, and one thing that I like about it, too, is this notion of collecting everything into these volumes. As I said in my introduction, I mean, I am of an age which we gathered together all of these cartoon books. And it wasn't just the three that I mentioned that everyone had, The Far Side and Bloom County and Calvin and Hobbes, but it was old Peanuts cartoons. And it was so many cartoons that I grew up with in that form where you could sit and quietly read one strip after another, maybe for hours at a time, while away a rainy day. And there's something, I think, Dan, about that, about being able to collect all the work in one place so that you can see it in that context as opposed to the day-by-day context.
Yeah, those books, The Complete Calvin and The Complete Far Side, those were my templates for this project. The only difference is that I'm going to keep going. This is not the end of my career. And I'm going to tell you, after raising $180,000 in a week, you'd better believe I'm going to keep going with this career, because suddenly it is very apparent to me that there's actually quite a lot of people, quite a lot of support for it.
They like me. They really, really like
me. Yeah, no, it is kind of my
self-feel. That's the thing with digital online. Yeah. It's a real crapshoot. You can get 180,000 or you can get nothing.
I mean, that's right.
It's pure democracy, which is scary in itself.
Well, Bob, talk about that, though, because this is really interesting, this idea of of making something that is complete, whether or not, as you say, you're going to do an exhibit at the Connecticut Historical Society, or you put together a book, or even a digital collection of your work, it is a very different way of presenting what you do than opening up the newspaper every day and saying, what's Engelhardt going to do today? And then having the color of that day color the way you think of it. If you see everything right next to each other, you see a very different, arc of work, I think.
Yeah, I think you do. I don't know about you, Dan, but when I go through my cartoons, sometimes it's kind of painful. It's like, oh, my God, I could have done. Have you found that to be true or not?
Yeah, you know, I have found a few things where I can't believe I missed the punchline or what you should have done. But,
yeah,
you know,
I could have drawn that better.
The thing, honestly, that was kind of wonderful and surprising was that mostly I went into this with a lot of trepidation. Mm. And as it turned out, I actually ended up thinking that the work was pretty good. I was pretty proud to be putting it out.
Excellent.
That's always a good feeling. We got a call from Tom, who's calling from Harwinton. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, Dan.
Hey.
Hey, Kevin Sutherland, a Connecticut native killed by a black thug on a DC bus. Why no coverage of it on your station?
Well, wow, you're calling during a show with two cartoonists to ask me that question? That's really interesting, Tom. Well done. Thank you very much. If you would like to call to talk with the two folks that we have on about this issue, that's fine. You can do that at 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. As a matter of fact, we're going to take a break. There's a lot more to talk about, including the fact that cartoonists were killed earlier this year, that the governor of Maine talked about shooting a cartoonist. Whether or not that's funny is, that's maybe up for some debate, depending on what side of this you're on. But if you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk with Bob Engelhardt and our friend Tom tomorrow, or Dan Perkins here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with two prominent local cartoonists. Award winners Dan Perkins, otherwise known as Tom Tomorrow. He's the author of the This Modern World comic strip, celebrating 25 years with a new retrospective that's coming out. You can find out more at his website, and we're going to put more links on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Also joining us is Bob Engelhardt. He's a longtime political cartoonist for the Hartford Courant. We're taking some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Bob, I've been wanting to ask you about the blog that you started putting together years ago that collects all of your daily cartoons in one place. One of the things I find fascinating about it, and Dan does the same thing, he writes quite a bit about his work on the side, is that when political cartoons stand on their own, you really only have that piece of art with that small caption that you can try to divine both what the cartoonist is trying to say and then also how you might interpret it differently than somebody else. But in your blog, you're in many ways explaining your thought process. I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about that and how being part of the creation of this work and then also commenting on the work yourself on a daily basis, how that's maybe changed things or how that is for you as an artist who used to just, you know, put something that was a square in the newspaper every day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the beauty of an editorial cartoon is it is its own little complete package and a little spot in the newspaper. And it says everything most of the time. But I love to write. I really love to write. And I enjoy writing about my cartoon or about the issue, or sometimes I'll write about something that has nothing to do with the cartoon. And there are days when I would rather write than draw. I mean, it's just the thing that goes back and forth. But I enjoy it, and now I'm trying to. I'm thinking of it as a package. It's the cartoon and the text go together, but the cartoon has to stand on its own because not everybody's going to read the blog.
One thing that one thing that I've found myself doing is, you know, and this happens every once in a while, I read your cartoon every day, and some days I go, I don't know. I'm not sure I exactly get what he's trying to do there.
Yeah.
But now you have a vehicle for doing that. In some ways, that's great, and in some ways, I don't know if it loses a little bit of magic, but it's a different relationship with a political cartoonist than it used to be, I think.
Yeah, it is. You know, I'll do cartoons that I know that only a few people are going to get it. But the people that get it are going to say, oh, my God, that's genius. Oh, this guy is incredible. Yeah. Everyone else will say, I don't get
it. Yeah, well,
it.
Hopefully those people are on the Pulitzer board, which is the important thing. I mean, talk about that, Dan, if you would, because there's the whole idea of your work standing on its own, and then there's the explaining your work behind the scenes, which sometimes can really help and sometimes may distract or detract from what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't blog as much as I used to, but I'll put up additional links and so forth, and I also have an email list that I send out that's a subscription thing, and I'll tell people there what I was thinking about. But that's a sort of self-selecting audience that is by definition more interested in hearing those stories.
Yeah. One of the things that you talked about when you got the news that you were a finalist for the Pulitzer was that you were surprised that a comic that was so verbal, that because your strip has so many words in it, that it might not be as appealing to the judges as some others. And as I read that, and I thought, you know, he's right. I never really thought about how many words are in each of your strips, but it's true. I mean, how did this style develop, Dan, over time, where you are packing, you know, these four frames sometimes full of a lot more text than most cartoonists of your type?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually start out to be a political cartoonist, and there's a sort of more traditional look of a political cartoon, which is often a single bold image. And that just wasn't really what I was aiming at when I started out. I grew up influenced by comic books and Mad Magazine and even Doonesbury, which is really a very text-heavy comic strip. And so the words always seemed as important to me as the images, and that was the that was what I liked doing. I liked the writing.
But Bob, how about you? You say you love writing so much, but as we know, so much of your work may just very well be a single image with maybe one word or no words. And so talk about that.
Well, to me, that's the pure form of a cartoon. And you look to the European cartoonist, very often they have no words in them at all because of the language barriers throughout Europe. So that's kind of a role model in one way. To me, that's the most pure cartoon, is a cartoon that's a picture that has no words and yet, ooh, really grabs you and you get the message.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on Mad Magazine. Words were important. Words are how humans convey ideas as well. I mean, I think it's a broad art form. There's room for all of these things.
Right, yes. I grew up on Mad, too, and the same strips you're talking about, and Far Side, and, I mean, you know, these guys just, when they left, such a huge hole in the industry, and I still feel it. Mm. I mean, I've still got, you know, Larson cartoons stuck in my head.
Oh, absolutely. And Calvin and Hobbes. I still miss that every day.
Oh, yeah.
I want to get to Marianne in Stonington. Marianne, thanks for calling. You're on Where We Live.
Hi there. Great conversation this morning. I just wanted to also give a shout out to Doonesbury, which I don't think I heard mentioned earlier, which certainly, you know, echoed the political relevance of the day for quite some time.
Yeah, one of the best.
Indeed. But I thought one of the coolest things I think I've ever seen was this interdisciplinary performance. It was at the Kate in Saybrook.
Cartoon dance music. That was called cartoon dance music.
Oh, my God. It was the most fabulous thing. So here's Bob Engelhart with an overhead projector, and there were dancers on stage dancing to a poem about the horrors of war. And it was one of the most compelling things I've ever seen. It was just terrific, and I wish it were captured on film somehow so other people could enjoy it.
Marianne, thanks so much for bringing that up. Can you tell us about that, Bob?
Yeah, this was an idea by Neely Bruce.
Who's a great composer who's been on our program before.
Right, yeah. And he had the idea that Brad Roth, the dancer, and I, the cartoonist, and he, the pianist, would combine these disciplines, and I would interpret his music, he would interpret my cartoons, we'd both interpret Brad's dancing, Brad would interpret our dancing, and we rehearsed this all in an improvisational style until we had like a program, and then we would put this on in colleges and at the Kate, like the caller said, and it was a lot of fun, and we've done it, I don't know, five or six times. We haven't done it since the Kate. We haven't done it since the Kate. It takes a lot of time, and none of us have time to spare.
That sounds great, though. One of the occupational hazards of this job is isolation.
Yes.
And when you get these chances to collaborate, those are the highlights.
Yes, and they were very inspiring to me. I mean, anytime I worked with these guys, you know, I just came away with ideas that I wanted to do. And yeah, it's a wonderful discipline.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk to Bob Englehart and Dan Perkins, otherwise known as Tom Tomorrow. Could you talk, Dan, about how you work and the way in which you work? You say it's very isolating. I've talked with other cartoonists about that. You know, you're sitting by yourself often. You don't get to riff off of other people in the same way. Could you explain your work process on a daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, I work at home. I go into my studio and read the news and stare at the internet until my eyes bleed and hopefully come up with something interesting that I have, something to write about that I have something interesting to say about and can do so in an amusing way. But because I started out in the alternative press and the old alt weeklies, like the late lamented New Haven Advocate came out on a weekly basis, I've always been on a weekly schedule. And so I've developed a rhythm where I'll spend a day or two doing, you know, intensive research and really thinking about what topic of the week I want to address. And, you know, so it's a lot of time alone staring at the computer.
doing a whole lot of research. How about you, Bob? How do you work on a daily basis?
Well, I work at the paper now, but for many years I worked out of the Middletown Bureau and most of the time at home. And the great thing about working at home is you can start drinking at one.
But now work that much more rich, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So now I'm working at the Current, and I'm in the newsroom at the Current, which is also, I mean, I'm not isolated anymore, and I've got people that I can show cartoons to and get critiques from, and you know, I'm involved now, and it's a little different.
You mentioned this earlier when you were talking about how you used to write cartoons about race, Bob, and how maybe that's changed over the years. Talk about how you approach something that is clearly going to be a controversial topic. It's either controversial because it's controversial in the American public at large, or because a cartoonist getting it wrong could cause a sensation or a controversy, but a cartoonist getting it right would hit a home run. Could you talk about working through very controversial issues?
Yeah, I have gotten it wrong on several occasions and had people marching on the Current. That has happened. Generally what I'm trying to do is say something that's not going to alienate the people I want to reach. And if I say it in the wrong way, people are just going to say, he's a racist, or he's a sexist, or he's this, or he's a liberal, or whatever. So I try to draw a cartoon in a way that can't be denied. The emotions can't be denied by anybody. But not everybody's going to get it. I mean, that's just the nature of cartoons. Not everybody gets it.
There will always be someone who will deny it, but I think that's a really good way to approach it, just to find, to be as true as possible, to put it out as true as possible and feel that you can back it up, and that's the best you can do.
Yeah.
But do either of you feel as though that you need to, over the course of time, move your targets around with the idea that, you know, if you're always skewering the Republican politician or you're always skewering the liberal, then over time your readers will think, well, here's how he feels, or here's how he feels. Do you ever look back and say, you know, I really need to find some new targets today? I don't know about you, Dan.
I'm not going after target. I mean, I'm coming at this from a consistent point of view. I'm definitely to the left of Obama, particularly when he started out, and he was very much a centrist politician. So I've I think that cartoonists should not give the sitting president a pass, even if he's more or less on their side of the fence. But I'm not just deliberately looking for targets. I'm trying to express the things that I think about what's going on. So, for instance, closing Guantanamo. I've been a huge critic of Obama's very slow move, very slow progress, I should say, on closing Guantanamo, because I think that that's a promise he should have fought harder to keep. And I understand there were a lot of obstacles in the way, but I think, topics like that, I'm not doing that because I think, oh, I should have Obama. I should do an Obama cartoon in order to keep my demographics shifting. I'm doing it because it's what I believe.
Yeah. No. And obviously, I think as I use the word target, I can hear it coming out of my mouth the wrong way. But at the same point,
I know what you mean. I pick targets.
Yeah. So you do pick
John
targets.
John Boehner's a target. Yeah. I mean, this guy, he has to say what he has to say to keep his position in Congress. I don't even know if he's telling the truth. And I've read so much about politicians in general. I don't know if any politician's telling the truth. They say the things they have to say to keep their base. It's all about the base. I'll pick a target when someone is being a bully or stupid. Or I mean, Donald Trump, there's my target. That's a target, man.
And it's such a target, and that's the thing. It's the target for everyone. Everyone, every political cartoonist. I mean,
sure.
Jon Stewart probably wishes he would have kept on the program for a little while longer, given the fact that Donald Trump is running for president.
Burke Breathed said that on his Facebook page, he said, well, Donald Trump inspired him to come back. So,
just to be a contrarian, though, I kind of hate this phase in politics because, honestly, the cartoons we're doing right now, the Donald Trump cartoons, 2 years from now, people are going to look back on those, and I'm kind of in this mindset because I've been putting together this compilation and looking back at what work has longer shelf life and what doesn't. You're going to look back in 2 years. It's like looking back at the Herman Cain cartoons. It's like, right, Herman Cain. I remember that moment where people were talking about him. Donald Trump is really not going to be the next president, and the ink we spill on Donald Trump is essentially wasted effort. It's just adding to the clown show, and I'm sure that I'm going to be joining in as much as anyone, but I kind of resent it in some way.
I resent it in terms of health of the democracy, but in terms of editorial cartoons, I was like, well, hey, this is fun. I enjoy it.
But I actually, I just mentioned Jon Stewart a moment ago, and I don't know, Dan, something about what you just said, and even just thinking about this current political climate, it makes me consider Jon Stewart and his kind of exasperated take as he decided to step away from The Daily Show. Essentially what he was saying was, there are so many easy targets. There is so much everyday ridiculousness about Fox News and all the things that he was doing every day. It almost seems as though he's lost his passion for doing what he does. And in many ways, his commentary in the day's news is very much like what you do and what Bob does. Is there some of that to you, Dan? I mean, do you worry at all about losing steam because of the nature of how ridiculous some of the things are that we concern ourselves with on a daily basis?
Yeah, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about in the course of putting the book together was, honestly, whether or not I wanted to continue doing this work, whether or not it was going to remain interesting. I'm feeling pretty upbeat about it at the moment.
That's the thing, and I feel that I've gone through the same thing you go through. That, I sorted a bunch of cartoons last year as part of the Current's 250th anniversary. And I went through cartoons going back into the 30s, and we don't have many cartoons before the 30s, but it's the same problems. People don't change. Politics doesn't change. Power grab doesn't change. It's the same problems over and over. And that's a little exhausting when you start to think about it. But at the same time, the reaction you're getting to your Kickstarter tells you how much people need this. I mean, I look at my job as public service.
Yeah, we're talking today about cartoons and cartooning with Bob Engelhart from The Current, Dan Perkins from This Modern World. You can join us at 860-275-7266. We've got a few more minutes left. Let's go to Gene, who's calling from Rye, New York. Hi there, Gene.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
Well, years ago, I worked in Hartford, and there was a cartoon in The Current which showed the then current chairman of Travelers being thrown off the tower.
Yeah, I did that.
As though he were some kind of a hero and this were something unjust. And I was wondering, since afterwards everybody knew that the reason a company, a small percentage of the size of Travelers was able to buy it was because of the actions of the chairman and the board.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you do cartoons, how do you balance the search for truth with whatever is the popular commentary at that time?
Well, it's a good question, Gene. I don't know, Bob, what do you say?
I don't search for truth as much as I search for my honest opinion. This is my honest opinion, what I think it's all about. Whether it's true or not, opinions are opinions, you know. They're not true. They're just opinions.
As you think about you, so you remember this cartoon he's talking about.
Oh, yeah. That's why I threw him off the Traverse Tower.
you still seem fairly pleased with it.
I love it. it was so fun to draw.
Well, I mean, we just have a couple minutes left, Dan, but I mean, I wanted to get to something that is very serious that happened earlier this year. I mentioned it earlier. I mean, these killings at Charlie Hebdo in Paris, it prompted this worldwide reaction, but there was a very complex reaction around it because it wasn't just about freedom of speech and the ability to draw or say what you will, but then it had these weird subtexts about Islam, and it had unusual subtexts about the ways in which these cartoons were drawn. As you look back now, 6 months later after this, what are some of your thoughts, Dan, about how we approached that really terrible episode and what it tells us about freedom of speech and the work that you do?
Well, the thing that makes me very sad about that, apart from the obviously tragedy itself, the thing that was almost a topic that there's just no way to discuss it. The work was jarring and ugly, and on the surface appeared to be racist and hateful. And then as you dove more into it and read people who understood it, who understood the language and understood the context, you would find out that these apparently racist images were satirizing things that were said by racist French politicians in the National Front. But a lot of people, you know, but so you've got then the question of, okay, but is it still an ugly racist image even in the service of being anti-racist? And a large number of people didn't even get to that point. So the conversation, there was so much noise around that conversation that it was just almost impossible to engage it at a certain point. And I'm sorry that so many people decided that the important thing about that topic was the way in which they misinterpreted these cartoons.
Mm. Well, I was actually thinking about many of your cartoons, Dan, that say have to do with gun control. And if you didn't know English and you didn't know a lot of the social context, one might very well take some of your work completely differently.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the thing that I think back on is the New Yorker cover, which had Barry Blitz cover in 2008, right before the election, which had was it 2008? You know, it had Obama and Michelle dressed up as terrorists, basically. It was this obvious, it could not have been a more obvious satire of the Fox News worldview if it had had a giant text block superimposed saying, this is a satire of the Fox World News view. And yet people, especially Democrats, really freaked out over that cover because I think mostly it was Democrats who were afraid that other people would take it seriously. But there was a huge controversy about this cover, and people thought he's drawing Obama as a terrorist. What is going on? This is terrible. I mean, we can't even get it right in our own culture, you know? Mm-hmm. So how can we expect to fully comprehend these cartoons that we don't even, in my case, I don't even speak the language?
Do you have a thought, Bob, on this?
Well, I met some of those cartoonists in Saint-Just-les-Martels in France in 2013. And so it was personal to me, well, for several reasons, but one is I met some of those guys. The other is I'm reminded how cartoons are some of the most powerful art forms on earth. And, you know, people who don't understand it will say things, oh, well, he's making it cartoonish. And I'm like, well, if you're going to make it cartoonish, it's going to be extremely powerful. So, let's just remember that images are powerful, can move people. And, you know, my goal is to move them in the right direction.
I have to ask you one last question, Bob, because we're just about out of time. Something happened recently to you. This happens to cartoonists worldwide as well. Sometimes their work is appropriated by others. You drew a very powerful three-panel strip as the Confederate flag was being voted on. And essentially, it was going, gone. It was the flag at full staff, half staff, and then it was gone. Someone took that, added on to it a little bit, and made a different product, didn't credit you. I guess I'm wondering if you could just talk through how that all resolved itself, because it's a very interesting window into the world of someone who does what you do.
Well, that has happened before. There was a guy in Oklahoma who stole one of my cartoons almost verbatim, and he was ultimately fired because of it. Vermont, the Republican Party, put one of my cartoons on their website and altered it to fit what they wanted it to say. And just recently there was a bail bondsman that put one of my cartoons on his website. So, but in the case of the flag cartoon, my editor Andrew Julian handled the whole thing masterfully, and we came away with it feeling okay. It does happen, and it's any, you know, I'm in the business because I like making these original cartoons. I like the process. I like making the notes and doing the research and having that little germ click in my head. I wouldn't want to do this if I was just taking other people's cartoons. I mean, that just is not interesting at all to me.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know, Dan, if you have a final thought on this, because it is one of the pitfalls of this world. You do something, especially in a digital world, that is so easily ripped off, and you have to, I'm sure, constantly both police your work, but then also think it's nice that people like it enough to use it in some way.
Well, yeah. Sorry, I mean, there's two different issues. It's lovely when people pass the cartoons around online. It's great that people are reading the work, but you do hope that they link back to the source so that people can find you and find out more about you. When people take it and put their own words in it, that's annoying. But, you know, at a certain point, you just have to hope that your own work is out there enough that people can tell the difference.
If you want to link to the direct source, it's thismodernworld.com. It's where Dan Perkins has a very successful Kickstarter on his new book. It's going to be 25 years of collected This Modern World cartoons. Dan Perkins, of course, writes as Tom Tomorrow. He's recently a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Dan, always good to speak with you. Thanks for joining us here on Where We Live.
Thanks, John.
Thanks also to Bob Engelhardt, the longtime political cartoonist at the Hartford Courant. Very good to see you, Bob. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to hear about a cartoonist in the pre-digital world, one who's maybe faded into a bit of obscurity. Some efforts now to bring back the name of Art Young. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow is Friday, so we're going to consider the 5-day work week. Wouldn't it be nice to just come to work 4 days a week? There's an awful lot of companies, maybe even some countries, that are looking seriously at whether the 5-day work week is actually what we should do, all notwithstanding what Jeb Bush thinks about all this. We're going to be talking about the 4-day work week, maybe the 4-day school week, coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking about the power of cartoons and cartooning. We've just been talking with two cartoonists who are working currently, but Mark Morash is someone who's trying to revive the work of Art Young, a cartoonist maybe long forgotten, but once thought of as one of the deans of the American cartoon. Mark Morash is publisher at Serafemera Books, on the board of directors at the Bethel Historical Society, and founded the Art Young Gallery. Joins us by phone today. Mark, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for helping us bring Art Young back to life.
So who was Art Young?
Art Young, dean of American cartoonists, best-known political cartoonist the first half of the 20th century, was published in everything. Puck, Judge, Life, Metropolitan, Saturday Evening Post, The New Yorker. He was really the inspiration for that first generation of New Yorker cartoons and cartoonists. If he was alive right now, he'd be illustrating for Bernie Sanders' campaign, without a doubt.
So why did he fall into obscurity? I mean, these are all, even this many years later, these are all publications that we know well. Why is his name not more widely known?
He lived in Bethel from 1904 to 1942, and he built himself an art gallery. And his plan was to save all of his illustrations and for his art gallery to live on for his entire, after he passed away. He was kind of a rarity. He had deals with all of his publishers that rather than destroy his originals, they'd send them back to him. So he gathered his 4,000 to 5,000 cartoons, but 18 months before he dies, he runs out of money. His friends convince him to sell the property, and he's stuck with all these cartoons. He dies. They wind up sitting in a warehouse for nearly 20 years, and then they get lost in the back of a warehouse in a bookstore. It's a story you can't make up. And so there was nothing out there. His cartoons are off the market. His books are out of print. And there goes Art Young.
My goodness. He had a connection to P.T. Barnum?
He had some connection to P.T. Barnum because P.T. Barnum was born here in Bethel. And while they had only met in passing once, he loved the showmanship. He loved what Barnum had done here. He wanted to be remembered in Bethel just like Barnum. And there are stories about Barnum where he had given a fountain to Bethel and it got torn down, and Art Young railed against them tearing down this beautiful statue. And also he tells the story of Barnum, who had gone to jail for 60 days for libel because he had a newspaper when he was young. And he tells the story, and he talks about Barnum getting out of jail, and Barnum, of course, being the showman, had a parade back to Bethel celebrating him getting out of jail with 60 carriages and a marching band. And so Art Young really looked at P.T. Barnum as, in some way, while Barnum wasn't a cartoonist, he was very political early on in life, and I think he felt a kinship to him.
And you're actually doing a lecture about these connections?
Correct, at the Barnum Museum on Sunday, on the 19th. Going to be talking about Art Young, going to be talking about Barnum. We're going to show the originals of the cartoons that Art Young did of P.T. Barnum, and we'll have a number of other illustrations there. He was very anti-capitalist and very anti-big business, and his best-known cartoon was a piece called Capitalism, with a big fat cat capitalist feasting at a table, and he's leaning back in his chair about to fall into the abyss. Art Young really made that styling of the fat cat capitalist, which eventually became, you know, kind of what we know as Mr. Monopoly. That comes from an Art Young idea.
My goodness. So some of his ideas would be very, very relevant right now. One of the manuscripts, though, that you've worked on is Types of the Old Hometown, about characters and caricatures in Bethel. This is something that went unpublished until the Bethel Historical Society published. Can you talk about this? Because this isn't, you know, these big ideas. This is really portraits of people.
It's portraits of people. He, in the 1920s, published a number of these in the Saturday Evening Post, things like the railroad station agent, the lamplighter, the village bell, and he would do these beautiful caricatures of these people, and not caricatures as in silly, but as in, you know, the type you would see in any town in America, and he would write a little blurb, a little story about them, and they were really, really popular in the Saturday Evening Post, so he put a manuscript together, and from 1935 until he passed away in 1943, he couldn't find a publisher. And the manuscript was lost, you know, in that warehouse and in the back of the bookstore until a gentleman in California by the name of Glenn Bray found it and rescued it and tucked it away. When he found out that my wife and I are bookmakers, literally handmade bookmakers, well, there was a perfect match. And so in January, we released Types of the Old Hometown, their handmade hardcover limited edition books. And we brought Art Young back into print for the first time in 80 years. And I have to say, every artist, every cartoonist, living or dead, should have a champion like Glenn Bray, who rescued that manuscript. It's absolutely wonderful.
I know you got to hear some of the conversation we had earlier. How do you think that his work would hold up, might be changed by the world we live in today?
Frankly, I don't think it would have. I think you could take 80-90% of what he illustrated and publish it today. He was pro-workers' rights. He fought against the poor treatment of the World War I soldiers. He has some horrifying cartoons about child labor practices. He was working with Margaret Sanger in the suffrage movement. He was friends with Langston Hughes and was doing work for racial equality. And at the end of his life, I mean, he was drawing anti-fascist cartoons against Hitler. The suffrage cartoons, that if you publish them today, they're just as relevant with everything that's going on in the world. And it's wonderful that they still work, but it's absolutely frightening that 100 years ago he was illustrating about the very same issues.
So, Mark, before I let you go, tell me again the various ways in which people can actually find out more about this treasure from Bethel. There's books, there's a gallery, you've got this lecture coming up. Well, where would you send people?
Okay, if you want to come see it live and see some of his original illustrations, the Barnum Museum in Bridgeport at 2 p.m. on Sunday the 19th. If you want to go online and see Types of the Old Hometown, artyounggallery.org, just like it's spelled. You can see the book. You can purchase the book. You can come out to the Bethel Historical Society in Bethel, Connecticut. We have a rotating long-term gallery display. We had just finished a huge display of 40 illustrations and about 120 pieces of ephemera. We don't have quite that much up right now, but we'll certainly show you through the archives if you like.
Mark Morash, publisher at Seraphemera Books on the Board of Directors at Bethel Historical Society, reintroducing us to Art Young. Thank you so much, Mark, for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for letting us come on.
Hey, very quickly, I'm going to go Marion in Deep River. Marion, I just have about 20 seconds for you. What's on your mind?
I'm also plugging an exhibit. It's the C.D. Batchelor exhibit, A Political Cartoonist. It's on from 2 to 4 on Saturdays and Sundays through September. He also was the first political cartoonist to win a Pulitzer Prize in 1937. And his cartoons are also very appropriate today, a little dated in terms of stylistic, but the message is very, very clear and He was a great humorist also.
Well, Marion, thank you so much. And again, that's the Deep River Historical Society. Thanks to Katie Tolarski, our executive producer, who produced today's program. Our technical producers, Kion Wolf, our digital editors, Heather Brandon. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.